The Placing You First podcast begins in less than 20 seconds.
Visit crcgroup.com to subscribe, download our award-winning tools and intel articles that help you stay aware of emerging issues and trends, or get a snapshot of the insurance marketplace with our industry-leading Ready Indexes. You'll find it all on crcgroup.com under Tools and Intel.
On September 28th, Hurricane Ian impacted Florida as a Category 4 storm with winds of 155 miles an hour. Today we talk about the hurricane with James Spann, a very popular television meteorologist from Birmingham, Alabama. He's been named the Broadcaster of the Year by the National Weather Association, earned multiple Emmy Awards, and was credited for saving lives during the tornado outbreak of 2011 in Alabama.
Nobody should be out there. This thing is going to be coming basically right down Skyland Boulevard. This is an extremely violent situation. Notice the power flashes.
And believe it or not, he even has his own fan-created theme song. Pretty catchy. And we'll also check in with Chris Carlson to get the insurance side of things. He's the property practice leader for CRC Group. James Spann and Chris Carlson are next right here on the podcast. Welcome to the Placing You First podcast from CRC Group. I'm your host, Dan Wentz, and this podcast features news and insights from CRC Group's vast knowledge base of 4,300 plus associates who write in excess of $23.5 billion of premium annually. And we're giving you insider access to what's happening in our company and the types of insurance we place.
This is the Placing You First podcast.
James, can you tell us a little bit about who you are, what your credentials are? I know that's almost insulting coming from someone in your market, but I'm sure some people will be eager to know.
No, I've been doing weather professionally for 44 years, which is a long time. I am a professional meteorologist, AMS certified, CBM number 33. The CBM is like our bar exam. And I will say we have a lot of weather entertainers across the world now that have massive audiences on TikTok and YouTube. And there's a lot of it can be a cesspool of really bad information. And we have great concern that credible professional meteorologists are losing our voice in situations like this, where people are focusing on the entertainers and the politicians, and that they've got voices in this thing now. So anyway, I'm just a lowly practitioner, professional meteorologist that's been doing this for 44 years here in the southeastern United States.
Yes, and you're very humble. You were on the air when I remember the tornadoes of, was that 2011, the big tornado that came through Tuscaloosa. Everybody was tuned in to James Spann. There's some great video of your coverage on that up on YouTube if anybody wants to go check it out. But yes, you're kind of a big deal in the world of weather. So
I'm just a nobody.
A
weather guy that loves what he does for a living.
No, but I will say that's this, and get ready to feel old, but Santa Claus here has been watching you since I was a child, and you were always our go-to man. Like my parents, my grandparents, everyone would be like, let's see what James Spann has to say about this storm.
Again, my main job, it's mitigating loss of life during tornado events. But having said that, I deal with tropical weather as well.
James, can you give us kind of the story of this storm? And I'm really interested to hear your perspective on it. We know it hit Florida. We know it was pretty bad around Fort Myers. But, you know, fill in some of the details for us.
Well, it's hurricane season. This is when these things happen. And I think a lot of people were being lulled to sleep. The season was very, very inactive through August and September. And a lot of folks were thinking, it's a dud. Nothing's going to happen, you know. And let me just say this. I don't like seasonal outlooks. I'm not a big fan of those where they come out before the hurricane season and give you the number of named storms and major storms and hurricanes. And that's interesting, I guess. But from a practical point, what do you do with that information if you live in say, New Orleans, or if you live in Galveston, or if you live in Fort Myers? I've never quite understood the point of what the end user should do. But most of the preseason outlooks were for a very active season. And that's not been the case. And in fact, if you take out Ian, it's been a very inactive season. So I think a lot of people were lulled to sleep. But Ian was a classic mid-season hurricane that came up on the into the Gulf of Mexico from the Caribbean. And it was a forecaster's challenge. And they all are. Understand, you know, the one thing that's missing from our science is humility. There's a lot of things we can do, and there's a lot of things we cannot do. And you know, trying to give you an exact forecast of a hurricane landfall point and the intensity 5 days in advance. That's tough. Now, having said that, the Hurricane Center did that. But the problem is they shifted the American global model, the global forecast system. And there's two primary global models, and there's more than that. But the two main ones in use are the American GFS and the European Center ECMWF. And the European model is typically more accurate, but the American model started to swing west, all the ensembles. And the Hurricane Center kind of bought into that. And if you noticed on the forecast track, it shifted initially. It was right. The forecast cone was toward Southwest Florida, but it shifted toward Tallahassee and Apalachee Bay and the Big Bend. And I think that probably cost us in terms of response and maybe some loss of life. We don't know that yet. We'll know more after the social science studies. But of course, it was shifted back and folks there had, you know, at least 24, 36 hours to get out of there. But at the time of landfall, this was an upper end category 4 hurricane, which was, you know, pretty wicked. These are fairly rare. It approached category 5 strength. Only 5 category 5s have made landfall in the United States. We had Michael, Camille. We had the Labor Day storm of 1935. But this one was an upper end category 4, and the storm surge was about 16 feet, and it went into a very densely populated area. Nothing about it was good. And you guys have seen the damage. It was reflective of how bad it was.
Was this track unique when it comes to hurricanes? I know that for my short time in the Southeast, I've been here for, I don't know, 10 years, something like that, 15 years. It seems like they all kind of go east to west or like curve up inside the Gulf. I haven't witnessed one going from the west to the east across Florida. Is that pretty common or was this unique?
You can find an analog to almost any hurricane track if you go back 100 years or more. And the obvious analog to this was Hurricane Charley that came through there in a very similar fashion, very similar point of landfall. But there are differences. All storms are different, even if they come in at the exact same place. The intensity, the radius of hurricane force winds, the storm surge, all of this stuff can be different. And Ian offered it was a bigger storm with a higher storm surge and a more expansive wind field. And the damage was more catastrophic in association with Ian. So this is not the first time it's happened, and it won't be the last time. But and again, the one thing we've learned is that what we do is not enough. We do physical science. That's all we do. And we know we have to integrate social science into what we do because we're asking people to do something. We're asking people to take action. And we're not experts in that. And so the social scientists, what they're going to do is come along and do a case study on this. And we're going to find out why in the world the death toll was so high. I think the death toll in Florida is hovering about 100. I've seen different numbers, and we really probably won't know the exact number until later because you've still got some people listed as missing. And hopefully they're just, you know, somewhere safe. We just don't know that yet. But it's obvious something went wrong here because in 2022, the loss of life should never be that high, even for an upper end category 4 hurricane like that. And of course, you get into questions like, were the evacuation orders issued in time? Did people listen to the orders? You know, how was the communication process leading up to the landfall? Was the shift a part of that, where for a while the hurricane forecast was shifted away from Southwest Florida toward the eastern part of the panhandle? Did that play into it? Did people see that and just not pay attention to updated forecast? And again, we'll know later once the social science studies are in, but we can't have this loss of life like this anymore. This is unacceptable. And you will always have some loss of life for a hurricane like this. Understand, some people won't do anything. Everybody makes their own decision. And for those people that will not leave, that will not take any action, we can't help them. But most people do want to help themselves. And I know that some people, you know, something went wrong here. So we'll find out later what went wrong. And we have to learn from it and be better, not only in the physical world, the physical science of forecasting, but also in the social science side of the evacuation orders and the whole process and all of that.
I've got a question. James, about the track of this storm. Now, I've lived in the Southeast most of my adult life, and I know that it's not uncommon, but it's fairly rare to have one cross over, re-strengthen, and come back up the eastern seaboard like that. How often is that the case? And what are the factors that contribute to that more than anything? I mean, other than just the path.
Well, hurricanes are steered by winds aloft, and there's a series of waves in the upper atmosphere, and where those waves are will determine if the hurricanes move west or they hook northeast. And this one got hung up in a trough. It was a real nice trough. And part of the problem with the forecast in the American model, the trough that turned this northeast was initially seen over the Gulf of Alaska, and the American model did not pick it up. And what the Weather Service did, they started initiating 4 balloon launches a day. We have to have upper air data into these models for the models to be good. Typically, we have 2 balloon launches a day, and that's it. And once they started 4 balloon launches a day at Weather Service offices all across the North America, including the Canadian sites, the GFS started to see it, and it started to shift back toward the European. But I think that really cost us, and that's a sign that junk in, junk out. That was the problem of the American model that day. But back to the original question, having a storm do that, that's not that unusual, because at some point, hurricanes are going to be picked up by the mid-latitude westerly winds aloft. They're going to turn north and then northeast. And the question is, where does that happen? And this just happened in the Gulf of Mexico, so it turned northeast over the Florida Peninsula. And understand, you can have other situations where hurricanes come in from the east and keep going westward, like Hurricane Andrew in 1992. So they could go either way across the peninsula like that. But this was a classic reminder that our friends in Tampa, you've got to pay attention. And I know that for a while, Tampa was in the core of the forecast cone. And for them, they were fortunate that the thing came into the south, and Tampa Bay got the offshore flow. They had a negative storm surge. The water was blown out of Tampa Bay, and so they had no problems there. But at some point, their luck's going to run out. Now, when does that happen? In 1 year, 5 years, 50 years? We don't know that, but at some point, that will happen.
And I'm sure a lot of people, especially in the insurance industry, are wondering what the likelihood of this happening again this year or in short order is, obviously, because they're very concerned not only with the loss of human life, but also the loss of property and all of that. And I know you're probably a little hesitant to predict things like that, but do you have any idea or is there any prevailing thought right now?
Oh, it could happen next month. I mean, hurricane season runs to the end of November, and it could happen next month. It could happen next year. It might be 5 years. It might be 50 years. We just don't know that. There's no skill in that. It's all we can do to figure out the weather 7 days in advance. But understand that obviously the problem here is that the population growth in places like Fort Myers and Fort Myers Beach and Naples and Sanibel, it's beautiful. I've been there many times. So many people. The population's exploded there. That's a rapidly growing part of Florida. And when that happens, you're waiting for a disaster to happen. It's going to happen. A hurricane will happen. It doesn't matter if you're in Tampa Bay, if you're in Miami and Fort Lauderdale and Daytona Beach, even Jacksonville. Jacksonville is probably the hardest city to get a hurricane hit in Florida because of the nature of the geography there. Of course, the panhandle, that's just waiting to happen again, like a Michael from 2018. It's going to happen. And as people continue to live there, it's just part of risk. Everybody in life has to take risks, and you've got to decide, you know, what is your risk tolerance? What will you tolerate in terms of risk? And for the people that decided to live there, they just decided they're going to take that risk. And again, for us, the concern is, you know, did people hear the evacuation order or see the storm surge warning or the hurricane warning and choose not to leave? Why did they not leave? You know, that's, I know in the insurance business, you're more concerned about the property side, which is a big part of it. Of course, our concern, it's the human life part of this thing. And we've got to find out what went wrong there, because as you start to learn about these people, you know, some were young, some were old. Most of these people drowned. And this is horrific. You don't even want to think about how terrifying it must have been to lose your life in a situation like that. I used to cover hurricanes. I've kind of stopped. I think we should be using cameras and not putting people out in them anymore. It's just my opinion. But I was in Eloise and Frederick and Andrew and so many of these things. And I will tell you, it is absolute terror. The noise alone will drive you crazy. The water, the wind, it just doesn't stop for hours and hours and hours. And I could not imagine anybody losing their life like that. And we've just got to figure out what happened in this situation.
Yeah. How do you motivate people to evacuate is really this. And I know from living in Florida for a period of time, there's those people that just are planted. They won't go. They've I've been through hurricanes like this before. It was nothing.
But again, we've got to understand, we've got to do better. We've got to learn. We've got to do better and look at this forecast situation and, you know, do better next time. What went wrong? What went right? What can we do better? And that's what we have to do with every situation like this. But this is a bad storm, and it's going to be a long, long road to recovery. Hurricane Michael in 2018, they're still recovering, and not just on the Gulf Coast in places like Mexico Beach, but inland like Mariana, Florida, that were so battered by this thing. This is a long, long, long journey to recovery here.
Well, James, I know we're running out of time here. Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Hey, my pleasure. Sorry, I'm not dressed for the TV thing here today, but I'm in between a school. I do school programs every day, and that's something that you need to do if you're going to do this. You got to catch kids and get them when they're young and get them understanding safety. And if you live in a hurricane zone, this is what hurricanes are. Don't be afraid of them. They don't happen that often, but this is what you do, and you have to understand them to mitigate fear and to generate interest. And they often lead the way in families where they'll get their parents to do the right thing. So I'm in a school every day, so I'm kind of between the morning shift doing the schools and the TV thing. So, but thank you, guys. This was fun. Y'all have a blessed day. Thanks for inviting me.
And now we check in with Chris Carlson, the property practice leader for CRC Group, to understand the effects of Hurricane Ian. A major, major storm has caused a lot of devastation across the Florida Peninsula. Let's start with this. How about damage estimates? That's kind of everyone's favorite topic when it comes to Hurricane Ian. I've heard estimates all over. But what do you think as far as damage estimates based on what you've seen in the media and also what that means for insurance?
Yeah. So in regards to damage estimates to Ian, I think you're starting to see some consensus around probably a $50, $40 billion number. We've seen estimates as low as 30, as high as 70. There's a lot of factors, I think, that would have to occur or go the wrong way to get it up to 70 billion, but it's really an unprecedented storm in an unprecedented economy, really.
What does that number mean? I mean, we like to throw around the 50 billion number, but how is that going to affect carriers and reinsurance moving forward?
Yeah, so you're looking at a marketplace that really couldn't have tolerated even a small event. An event the size of 50 billion is really going to impact, you know, capital providers throughout the chain. I think a lot of people think about their personal or their, you know, direct relationship with a carrier. But those carriers also buy insurance, reinsurance, and those reinsurers also buy insurance called retrocession. So that event is going to trickle through the insurance marketplace and cause some real struggles. I think before, you know, the last 3 or 4 years, it's been a pricing or an earnings push on rate. And what this is going to entail is really a true hard market cycle where people are not willing to risk capital in catastrophe exposed areas.
Yeah, and you've got this combined with the economy. So I've been seeing a lot of economic indicators just in general that we may not be heading the right direction. In fact, this morning I saw something about inflation being higher than expected. They just released a new report on that. So all of that kind of points to a hardening market, right? Harder than it has been.
Absolutely. And even more uncertainty around that, right? You know, you have carriers, you're looking at balance sheets and exposure bases that are on 20 and even 2021 values or costs. And now you have an event and you're going to rebuild in a, like you said, extremely high inflationary economy. You know, maybe what they thought was a $35 billion event does turn into $70 billion just due to the economic conditions.
Assuming this is going to make the market a lot harder, what can retailers expect moving forward as they look forward to their 2023 renewals?
Early and often, and a lot of dialogue. I think we're probably going to circle back on 1-1 and find out where the dust settles. Right now, you're in a marketplace where carriers are buying their reinsurance. So what ultimately will happen, no different than the loss estimates, is really how much does it cost for these carriers to renew their protection? And then how do those costs pass back into the marketplace? What retailers can expect, though, is a continued push on valuation. You know, looking at your values for your building or your property or personal property and making sure those are up to date or that there's a story around why you think they are what they are. Carriers are now being pushed by their capital providers to make sure that they're accounting for inflation. So I think that'll be the big push. There'll be a continued rate push, even on non-catastrophic exposed business. There are people who, you know, have risks in Minnesota and are wondering why they're going to pay more for their insurance. They don't have Florida risks, but it's a global reinsurance marketplace, so those costs are passed around. But that would be my takeaway: increase on rate, as well as a focus on valuation, and there may be a premium uplift there even if you don't get a rate increase, they'll be looking for more premium to account for the increased exposure.
And this may be a little bit of a curveball to you, so sorry. But what about Florida specifically? You know, I haven't been in insurance when a major, major hurricane has hit yet. What's the effect going to be on this, especially for those that are trying to renew in Florida?
Yeah, it's a bit, it's chaotic. You'll have the state involved. You'll have loss adjusting firms involved. It's more and let the dust settle. If you're a true Florida exposed carrier, you know, you see them in the news. There's a Demotech is the rating agency for the state of Florida. It's going to create havoc because most loans and banks, you know, want A-rated carriers, and you have to buy insurance from an A-rated carrier to secure funding or a mortgage. So it will create some serious issues. The industry always finds a way to solve problems. So there's probably some sideline capital that will see the marketplace as an opportunity and step in and provide relief. Or alternatively, the state, you know, can pass surcharges through, and you'll see Citizens and other state-backed carriers become maybe the, instead of a carrier of last resort, a carrier of first choice. So it's a really ever-evolving marketplace down there.
Okay, thanks a lot, Chris. We appreciate the information. And as the Hurricane Ian claims start to develop and we start to understand exactly what it looks like, we will let you know more information, both on our Tools and Intel blog at crcgroup.com and, of course, right here on this podcast.
Are you ready to take your career to the next level?
Join Team CRC to gain access to best-in-class tools, data, exclusive programs, and more. Send your resume to resumes@crcgroup.com and read testimonials from our recent hires on LinkedIn. Search for CRC.